armour, firepower, mobility.
This is what we call the iron triangle, the essential components of the tank.
Please remember to like, subscribe, or click the little notification bell if you don't want to miss out on these videos. And I'd just like to say thank you to all our patrons for making this possible. Please join them if you can.
In this episode, we're going to be looking at the evolution of firepower from the First World War up to the present day, and specifically the main gun, the main armament of the tank.
It's a history which mirrors the changing role and requirements of the tank on the battlefield, from supporting infantry to fighting other tanks.
Now, this is a massive, complicated subject, and all we can give you here is an overview. So if there's anything you think we've missed out or anything you'd like to hear more about, please leave a comment below. Let's start at the beginning. On the Somme in 1916.
A stalemate of trench warfare demanded an innovative solution. Machine guns and barbed wire resulted in huge infantry casualties in no man's land.
That's why we see the invention of the tank, first used by the British Army in September 1916.
They were to provide close fire support for the infantry, smashing through defences and barbed wire so the troops could follow in behind and exploit the gaps the tanks had made.
British heavy tanks in the First World War, and this is the last surviving example of Mark I, which is the first type of tank ever to see action, come in two types. There are males and there are females, and they're designed to solve two different problems on the battlefield. Now, the females are machine gun armed. First of all, Vickers guns, then Lewis, and then Hotchkiss. They're different weapons. The Vickers gun is belt-fed, the other two are magazine-fed. But the thing they've got about them is they've all got roughly the same rate of fire, roughly 450 to 500 rounds a minute. Now, if a burst like that hits you at close range, it will more or less cut you in half.
Females were effectively mobile machine gun nests, designed to pour fire on the enemy defending their trenches.
The males are armed with six-pounder guns like this, a Hotchkiss QF six-pounder. And the job of these males is to knock out German concrete fortifications.
Originally used on warships, these fired a semi-armour-piercing round that weighed 6 pounds, or roughly 2.5 kilograms.
Now we call, in the British Army, we call this a six-pounder. That's the actual weight of the shell it fires. But the other description would be a 57mm gun. And what that is the diameter of the bore of the barrel. So you can either have a 6-pounder or a 57mm. They're exactly the same thing.
Inside the tank, the gunners, one on each side, use body weight to traverse, aim, and fire the gun.
Maximum range was supposed to be 5,000 yards, that's about 4.5 kilometres, but you wouldn't stand a chance of hitting anything at that distance. Actual range was more like 200 yards, that's less than 200 metres. And if the tank was moving, it'd be a lot less.
The 6-pounder gun barrel also had to be shortened by just under a metre, as the longer barrel would plough into the ground as the tank moved. But this didn't impact accuracy to any great degree at short ranges.
While the story of the tank in World War I isn't one of universal success, there are a good many instances where they perform superbly at a tactical level, supporting infantry.
From their first use in 1916, when a mail tank neutralised a machine gun position that was preventing the infantry securing the village of Fleur, at Cambrai in 1917, where the tanks knocked a hole in the Hindenburg line, 6 miles wide and 3 miles deep. And during the spectacular British and Commonwealth advances during the last 100 days of the war, which opened the door to ultimate victory.
But before the war ended, there'd be a battlefield encounter that would show the way that wars were to be fought in the future.
In April 1918, a British Mark IV Mail encountered a German A7V Sturmpanzer in the first tank versus tank engagement. After some manoeuvring, firing, the Mark IV was able to score three hits on the A7V, which killed several crew members and caused the rest to abandon the vehicle.
It's worth noting that the Mark IV had to stop in order to fire accurately. And this is probably because the gunners weren't adept at firing on the move. They certainly weren't trained to fire at a moving target, and definitely not another tank. Lessons would be learned. By the time of World War II, the role of the tank has changed. It's not just about supporting infantry, knocking out fixed fortifications. Now, tanks have got to be able to fight other tanks.
Tank and anti-tank guns were designed specifically to destroy enemy armour. They were designed to fire an armour-piercing round, usually at this stage solid shot, at high velocity to punch through the armour of an enemy tank. In response, tank armour was made thicker. And in response to that, guns had to become more powerful to penetrate them. And this went on throughout the war, explaining why there are so many different types of tank designs emerging and falling out of use between the mid-1930s and mid-1940s. And you can see this in our World War II haul.
In the early part of the war, quite a few British tanks, like this Matilda II, like the Valentine, were armed with the two-pounder tank gun. And this is the round that it fired. It's actually not quite as bad as it looks. This is a high-velocity armour-piercing round, and this will penetrate up to 2 inches of armour, up to about 500 yards. And that actually compares pretty favourably with some of the other weapons of the period, things like the PAK-36, the German anti-tank gun, and the French 25mm. Matilda was really rather loved by her crews. Thick armour, good protection, and she could deal with the enemy tanks of the early war period. Things like the Panzer 1, 2, 3, that Italian 1340 over there. The problem starts when bigger, tougher enemy armour starts turning up. And we're talking about things like the Panzer 4. That, I'm afraid, is the point where the poor little two-pounder has had its day.
With so many British tanks armed with this gun, there was an attempt to make the two-pounder more effective. This is a piece of kit called the Little John Adapter. It's an extension to the barrel that uses a technique called squeeze bore. This increases the pressure behind the round when it's fired to almost double the velocity at which it leaves the muzzle, increasing its ability to penetrate armour. It was a bit cumbersome to use and required its own ammunition, so it didn't really take off, and the two-pounder needed to be replaced.
The Matilda was too small and too slow to be upgunned. So after a moment of glory in the Western Desert, Matilda was obsolete by 1942.
However, its contemporary, the Valentine, was able to be upgunned to carry the six-pounder. A number of Valentines were also converted to carry the 17-pounder anti-tank gun as Valentine archers, where their effective life as a tank was over.
Of course, there are quite a few examples of tanks being successfully upgunned. You can think about the Panzer III, the Panzer IV here, and I suppose probably the most famous is the T-34, and that gets a bigger turret, a bigger gun, and the T-34-76 is transformed into the T-34-85. Now, throughout the war, there is still a major need for tanks to be able to support infantry. Most of the 50,000 odd Shermans that were built were equipped with this. This is the M3 75mm gun. Now, it's a good weapon in many, many ways. It's based on the French 75mm field gun from the First World War. And in terms of supporting infantry, it's very, very good at
firing the 75mm high explosive shell. With AP, it can also deal with quite a number of the earlier German tanks. I mean, certainly Panzer III, Panzer IV. Things start to get a bit sticky when it encounters the heavier German armour of the latter part of the war. I'm probably thinking about Panther and Tiger here.
The heavy reliance on the Sherman tank by the US and British armies made this a major issue.
The US army would eventually upgun their Shermans with a more powerful 76mm gun. But the British army wanted to get something in place before D-Day. So their solution was to shoehorn the proven 17-pounder anti-tank gun into the Sherman turret.
This was incredibly difficult, as the 17-pounder is a much bigger weapon, and it involved chopping the back off the turret and welding on a bustle. And the breech had to be redesigned to open sideways rather than vertically.
And the crew had to drop from 5 to 4. But the result was the Sherman Firefly, which could fire a 17-pounder armour-piercing round, which will penetrate up to 162 millimetres of armour at up to 1,000 metres. And it is extremely bloody heavy. I really don't know how, in the confines of that turret, you could load this into the breech of the gun.
Around 2,000 Shermans were upgunned as Fireflies for British, Commonwealth and Polish units and deployed as one per troop of conventionally armed tanks. It's a solution famously demonstrated near Caen in July 1944, when a Firefly of the Northamptonshire Yeomanry destroyed 3 Tiger I's in 12 minutes with 5 rounds.
Now, the Tiger itself was built to pack a punch. Tiger was famously designed around the Kampfwagen Kanone 36 tank gun. And that itself was derived from the Flak 36 anti-aircraft gun. That had been used with great success in the early stages of the war in an anti-tank role, because it's got an enormous muzzle velocity, just about a flat trajectory. Now, a big gun needed to be mounted in a big tank. So here you have an instance of a proven anti-tank weapon influencing the design and the final size of the vehicle that is mounted in. And this is the round that it fired. This is the 88mm, and this was capable of spoiling the day of lots of Allied tank crew.
I'm feeling really quite privileged to be sitting here in the gunner's seat of Tiger 131, next to the breech of the KWK 36 gun, the 88. The whole thing here is that as guns improve, naturally so does gunnery. Ranges increase. So in World War I, you're looking at 200 yards maximum to achieve a hit on the target, probably rather less. In World War II, that's going up to, in some cases, over 1,000 yards. Although in combat conditions, it's generally the average is around about 500 yards for a tank-on-tank kill. Things like turret traverse times are improving as well. We're looking at perhaps 15 to 20 seconds for a full 360-degree traverse. We also have improvements in things like gun stabilisation. It won't get to the stage during World War II where it's possible to accurately fire on the move. That's going to happen well post-war. There's also other things. I mean, things like improvements in gun sights, and particularly German tanks, things like the Panther and this Tiger. Magnificent optics, adjustable magnification, and graticules that make it possible to accurately gauge range, and obviously that's extremely important in terms of accurate gunnery.
As tank guns grow bigger and more powerful, their appearance starts to change. Now, this Churchill is mounting a 6-pounder gun, and on the end, there's a counterweight. And that's a very simple piece of kit. It's a heavyweight, and all it does is to balance out the gun so that it's easier to elevate and depress manually. Something you do find on a lot of tank guns are fittings like this. Now, this is called a muzzle brake. And what that is, it's all to do with dealing with recoil. Now, remember your Newton's third law, bit of physics. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. So the shell goes that way, the gun jumps back. If you've ever fired a rifle, you'll know. It kicks back into your shoulder. But if you scale that up to something like a tank gun, that can be a big problem because the amount of force coming back at you is enough to damage the gun and its mountings. Now, what a muzzle brake does, it's just a very simple fitting, but it's got vents at the side facing slightly backwards. When the gun's fired, some of the muzzle blast comes out sideways, as I said, slightly backwards. And odd as it may seem, that is enough to damp down up to 50% of the recoil. And the rest of it is dealt with by the hydraulic recoil cylinder on the gun mount itself. World War II is the period when the tank as a weapon system really comes of age. And you've only got to look at the contrast between this early war Matilda I and this late war Comet to understand that. The only thing is that even by the end of the war, we haven't come up with something termed the universal tank. And that's a tank that's capable of fulfilling all the necessary roles, whether it's fighting other tanks or infantry support or whatever.
But the post-war era would be dominated by the main battle tank. Tanks that can engage a variety of targets, from armoured to soft-skin vehicles, infantry, buildings and fortifications.
Inside both this is the Chieftain main battle tank from the 1960s, and later on the Challenger 1 was the Royal Ordnance Factory's L11 120mm gun. It was regarded as the best tank gun in the world when it was introduced, and it certainly brought with it some innovations.
In fact, a Challenger 1 mounting the L11 gun holds the record for the longest tank-on-tank kill, knocking out an Iraqi T-55 at a range of 5,100 metres.
I'm here in the loader operator's position on the left-hand side of the turret of one of the British Army's Chieftain tanks, and this is the breech of the L-11 gun. Now, the L-11 is a rifled gun, 120mm gun, and it can fire armour-piercing rounds, it can fire high-explosive rounds, it can also fire smoke. Now, the armour-piercing round most commonly used in modern warfare is one of these, and this is APFSDS. What that means is armour-piercing, fin-stabilised, discarding sabot. It's a bit of a mouthful, so we can't often call it a fin round, just for short. What it is, this central bit, is a dart of a very, very dense material, something like tungsten alloy or very often depleted uranium. That is enclosed by a sabot. What that is, that's a jacket that actually guides it down the barrel. When it leaves the barrel, the sabot falls off and the dart continues onto the target.
The dart is travelling at up to 1,800 metres per second, or 4,000 miles an hour. And the effect of this slug of extremely dense material, travelling incredibly fast, produces catastrophic amounts of kinetic energy. The round will penetrate tank armour, and fragments of armour, plus the round itself, will shred just about everything in the target area. Crew, systems, you name it. Depleted uranium is also pyrophoric, meaning that white-hot fragments of the round ignite with air and burn out the vehicle interior. If your vehicle is hit by an APFSDS round, chances are you'll be shredded, incinerated, or both.
Now, you'll see that this is a very confined space, and owing to the increasing size of modern tank rounds, what we do these days is to split the round and the propellant into two. So you load the round to begin with, and then you load something called a bag charge. And this gives us a bit more flexibility because this is a half bag. So this is what you'd use with something like a Hesh round, long, low lob. And then this one, these are obviously drill chargers. This is a full bag. So that's the maximum amount of propellant. And that is what you'd use with a fin round with APFSDS, because that's got to have maximum force behind it. Increasing ranges, and you know, we're talking well over 2 kilometres here, brought the need for better technology.
TOGS, the thermal observation and gunnery sight used on Chieftain and Challenger 1, enables enemy assets to be targeted at night, in poor visibility, and at extreme ranges.
It's obviously a great advantage in tank combat to be able to fire on the move. But what you need for that, what's called a fully stabilised gun, took an awful long time to get right. And first British designers and then Soviet designers came up with a stabilisation system. The stabilisation system uses gyroscopes and servo motors to actually keep the gun straight and level as the tank's moving. And if you couple that with laser rangefinder, say, and a gunnery computer, you have got a weapon. You've got a tank that can fire and hit another tank while both the target tank and the firing tank are moving. When you start looking at modern tank guns like the L30A1 on this Challenger 2 main battle tank, there are even more humps and bumps. Now, to start off with, if you look at the jacket around the barrel, that is thermal cladding. And it's a bit like lagging around a hot water pipe or something like that. What that's all about is if there is some sort of external factor, like an icy breeze blowing from one direction or fierce sunlight, it might cause the barrel to warp slightly. Now, this is going to be sub-millimetric, but if you're aiming at a target that might be a few kilometres away, that is enough to make a difference. You then got the big bump in the middle. That's what we call the fume extractor. Now, when the gun fires, the barrel will fill with poisonous fumes. If you open breech, they'll flow back into the crew compartment. That's not very good for the crew. So what the fume extractor is all about, inside it, there's a circle of holes actually drilled down into the barrel. When the round comes up the barrel, the vacuum created pulls all the muck into the fume extractor, and that acts as a reservoir. When the round leaves, it flows out at the end, it's pulled out by vacuum, and you can see this if you watch a tank gun firing. The gun will recoil, come forward, and then there'll be a little puff of smoke out at the end. That is the fume extractor venting itself. Then you've got the little cap right at the end of the barrel. Now under that, there is a small mirror. And this is what we call the MRS, the muzzle reference system. Now, the reason we've got that is that tank guns and sights need to be very precisely aligned, quite obviously, and they can be knocked out. But using the MRS, the gunner can look through his sights and adjust the sights accordingly so that the gun and the sights are in precise alignment. The Challenger 2 gun can fire APFSDS, it can fire smoke, or it can fire these. This is HESH, High Explosive Squash Head. What this is a dustbin load of HE fired with a half bag charge and a long, low lob. Now, what you quite often use this against is structures, soft skin vehicles, but you can use it against enemy armour as well.
A HESH round impacts on the armour of the vehicle and detonates. The transmitted force blasts a very nasty and destructive scab of metal off the inside of the armour and sends this flying into the vehicle interior.
The only thing about HESH is it has to be fired from a rifled gun. And that's why the British Army, almost uniquely at the moment, still fits rifled ordnance to its tanks. Everybody else has gone smoothbore because you don't need a rifled barrel for APFSDS, you don't need it for high explosive anti-tank. I mean, what rifling's all about is their grooves cut down the barrel. They describe a quarter turn on the way down, and what that does is it spins the round, and it makes it more accurate.
more stable in flight.
However, it's expected that the British Army's next generation MBT, Challenger 3, will mount a smoothbore gun when it enters service later this decade, finally bringing the British Army into line with other NATO countries.
In this video, we've seen how the firepower of the tank has become far more accurate, more devastating, much more sophisticated. The science of tank gunnery has come a huge way since the Mark I, the First World War, almost sort of point and go techniques, right the way up to that long range gunnery feat achieved by the Challenger 1 in the First Gulf War. As battlefield technology evolves, so will the need to come up with even more new and ingenious methods of destroying enemy targets if the tank is to remain relevant for another century.
I hope you enjoyed this video. If you did, please like and don't forget to subscribe.